His insecurity, he says, May said.
That's what he told you, Francis Garaventa?
I guess he shouldn't have.
Well, it's not like he's in security. He's not Mossad. But did I interrupt something you definitely shouldn't be doing on your first night here, you idiot?
You didn't interrupt anything.
I think I did.
No, not really.
I did. I know this.
Annie located the bottle at May's feet.
I thought we ran out of everything hours ago.
There was some wine in the waterfall by the Industrial Revolution.
Oh, right. People hide things there.
I just heard myself say there was some wine in the waterfall by the Industrial Revolution.
Annie looked across the campus.
I know. Shit. I know.
At home, after the shuttle, after a jello shot someone gave her on board, after listening to the shuttle driver talk wistfully about his family, his twins, his wife, who had gout, May couldn't sleep. She lay on her cheap futon in her tiny room, in the railroad apartment she shared with two near strangers, both of them flight attendants and rarely seen. Her apartment was on the second floor of a former motel, and it was humble, uncleanable, smelling of the desperation and bad cooking of its former residents. It was a sad place, especially after a day at the Circle, where all was made with care and love and the gift of a good eye. In her wretched low bed, May slept for a few hours, woke up, recounted the day and the night, thought of Annie and Francis, and Denise and Josiah, and the fireman's pole and the Enola Gay, and the waterfall, and the tiki torches, all of these things the stuff of vacations and dreams and impossible to maintain. But then she knew, and this is what was keeping her up, her head careening with something like a toddler's joy, that she would be going back to that place, the place where all these things happened. She was welcome there, employed there. She got to work early. When she arrived, though, at 8, she realized she hadn't been given a desk, at least not a real desk, and so she had nowhere to go. She waited an hour under a sign that said, Let's do this, let's do all of this, until Renata arrived and brought her to the second floor of the Renaissance, into a large room the size of a basketball court, where there were about 20 desks, all different, all shaped from blonde wood into desktops of organic shapes. They were separated by dividers of glass and arranged in groups of 5, like petals on a flower. None were occupied.
You're the first here, Renata said.
But you won't be alone for long. Each new customer experience area tends to fill pretty quickly, and you're not far from all the more senior people.
And here she swept her arm around, indicating about a dozen offices surrounding the open space. The occupants of each were visible through the glass walls, each of the supervisors somewhere between 26 and 32, starting their day, seeming relaxed, competent, wise.
The designers really like glass, eh? May said, smiling.
Renata stopped, furrowed her brow in thought on this notion. She put a strand of hair behind her ear and said,
I think so. I can check, but first we should explain the setup and what to expect on your first real day.
Renata explained the features of the desk and chair and screen, all of which had been ergonomically perfected and could be adjusted for those who wanted to work standing up.
You can set your stuff down and adjust your chair and, oh, looks like you have a welcoming committee. Don't get up, she said, and made way.
May followed Renata's eyeline and saw a trio of young faces making their way to her. A balding man in his late 20s extended his hand. May shook it, and he put an oversized tablet on the desk in front of her.
Hi, May, I'm Rob from payroll. Bet you're glad to see me.
He smiled, then laughed heartily, as if he just realized anew the humor in his repartee.
Okay, he said. We filled out everything here. There's just these 3 places you need to sign.
He pointed to the screen where yellow rectangles flashed, asking for her signature. When she was finished, Rob took the tablet and smiled with great warmth.
Thank you, and welcome aboard.
He turned and left, and was replaced by a full-figured woman with flawless copper skin.
Hi, May. I'm Tasha, the notary.
She held out a wide book.
You have your driver's license.
May gave it to her. Great.
I need 3 signatures from you. Don't ask me why, and don't ask me why this is on paper. Government rules.
Tasha pointed to 3 consecutive boxes, and May signed her name in each.
Thank you,
Tasha said, and now held out a blue ink pad. Now your fingerprint next to each. Don't worry, this ink won't stain. You'll see.
May pushed her thumb into the pad, and then into the boxes next to each of her 3 signatures. The ink was visible on the page, but when May looked at her thumb, it was absolutely clean.
Tasha's eyebrows arched, registering May's delight.
See? It's invisible. The only place it shows up is in this book.
This was the sort of thing May had come for. Everything was done better here. Even the fingerprint ink was advanced. Invisible.
When Tasha left, she was replaced by a thin man in a red zippered shirt. He shook May's hand.
Hi, I'm John. I emailed you yesterday about bringing your birth certificate.
His hands came together as if in prayer.
May retrieved the certificate from her bag, and John's eyes lit up.
You brought it!
He clapped quickly, silently, and revealed a mouth of tiny teeth.
No one remembers the first time. You're my new favorite.
He took the certificate, promising to return it after he'd made a copy. Behind him was a 4th staff member, this one a beatific-looking man of about 35, by far the oldest person May had met that day.
Hi, May. I'm Brandon, and I have the honor of giving you your new tablet.
He was holding a gleaming object, translucent, its edges black and smooth as obsidian. May was stunned.
These haven't been released yet.
Brandon smiled broadly.
It's 4 times as fast as its predecessor. I've been playing with mine all week. It's very cool.
And I get one?
You already did, he said. It's got your name on it.
He turned the tablet on its side to reveal that it had been inscribed with May's full name, Maybelline Renner Holland. He handed it to her. It was the weight of a paper plate.
Now, I'm assuming you have your own tablet?
I do. Well, a laptop anyway.
Laptop? Wow, can I see it?
May pointed to it.
Now I feel like I should chuck it in the trash.
Brandon paled.
No, don't do that. At least recycle it.
Oh, no, I was just kidding, May said.
I'll probably hold on to it. I have all my stuff on it.
Good segue, May.
That's what I'm here to do next. We should transfer all your stuff to the new tablet.
Oh, I can do that.
Would you grant me the honor? I've trained all my life for this very moment.
May laughed and pushed her chair out of the way. Brandon knelt next to her desk and put the new tablet next to her laptop. In minutes, he had transferred all her information and accounts.
Okay, now let's do the same with your phone. Ta-da!
He reached into his bag and unveiled a new phone a few significant steps ahead of her own. Like the tablet, it had her name already engraved on the back. He set both phones, new and old, on the desk next to each other and quickly, wirelessly, transferred everything within from one to the other.
Okay, now everything you had on your other phone and on your hard drive is accessible here on the tablet and your new phone, but it's also backed up in the cloud and on our servers. Your music, your photos, your messages, your data, it can never be lost. You lose this tablet or phone, it takes exactly 6 minutes to retrieve all your stuff and dump it on the next one. It'll be here next year and next century.
They both looked at the new devices.
I wish our system existed 10 years ago, he said. I fried 2 different hard drives back then, and it's like having your house burned down with all your belongings inside.
Brandon stood up.
Thank you, May said.
No sweat, he said. In this way we can send you updates for the software, the apps, everything, and know you're current. Everyone in CE has to be on the same version of any given software, as you can imagine.
I think that's it, he said, backing away.
Then he stopped.
Oh, and it's crucial that all company devices are password protected, so I gave you one. It's written here.
He handed her a slip of paper bearing a series of digits and numerals and obscure typographical symbols.
I hope you can memorize it today and then throw this away. Deal?
Yes, deal. We can change the password later if you want. Just let me know and I'll give you a new one. They're all computer-generated.
May took her old laptop and moved it toward her bag. Brandon looked at it like it was an invasive species.
You want me to get rid of it? We do it in a very environmentally friendly way.
Maybe tomorrow, she said. I want to say goodbye.
Brandon smiled indulgently.
Oh, I get it.
Okay, then.
He gave a bow and left. And behind him, she saw Annie. She was holding her knuckle up to her chin, tilting her head.
There's my little girl, grown up at last.
May got up and wrapped her arms around her.
Thank you,
she said into Annie's neck.
Aw.
Annie tried to pull away. May grabbed her tighter.
Really? It's okay.
Annie finally extricated herself.
Easy there, or maybe keep going. It was starting to get sexy.
Really? Thank you,
May said, her voice quaking.
No, no, no,
Annie said.
No crying on your second day.
I'm sorry. I'm just so grateful.
Stop.
Annie moved in and held her again.
Stop. Stop. Jesus, you are such a freak.
May breathed deeply until she was calm again.
I think I have it under control now. Oh, my dad says he loves you too. Everyone's so happy.
Okay, that's a little strange given I've never met him, but tell him I love him too, passionately. Is he hot? A silver fox? A swinger? Maybe we can work something out. Now can we get to work around here?
Yep, yep,
May said, sitting down again.
Sorry.
Annie arched her eyebrows mischievously.
I feel like school's about to start and we just found out we got put in the same home room. They give you a new tablet?
Just now.
Let me see.
Annie inspected it.
Oh, the engraving is a nice touch. We're going to get in such trouble together, aren't we?
I hope so.
Okay, here comes your team leader.
Hi, Dan.
May rushed to wipe any moisture from her face. She looked past Annie to see a handsome man, compact and tidy, approaching. He wore a brown hoodie and a smile of great contentment.
Hi, Annie. How are you?
He said, shaking her hand.
Good, Dan.
I'm so glad, Annie.
You got a good one here, I hope you know,
Annie said, grabbing May's wrist and squeezing.
Oh, I do know, he said.
You watch out for her.
I will,
he said, and turned from Annie to May. His smile of contentment grew into something like absolute certainty.
I'll be watching you watch her,
Annie said.
Glad to know it, he said.
See you at lunch,
Annie said to May, and was gone. Everyone but May and Dan had left, but his smile hadn't changed. It was the smile of a man who did not smile for show. It was the smile of a man who was exactly where he wanted to be. He pulled up a chair.
So good to see you here, he said.
I'm very glad you accepted our offer.
May looked into his eyes for signs of disingenuousness, given there was no rational person who would have declined an invitation to work here. But there was nothing like that. Dan had interviewed her 3 times for the job and had seemed unshakably sincere each time.
So I assume all the paperwork and fingerprints are done?
I think so.
Like to take a walk?
They left her desk and, after 100 yards of glass hallway, walked through high double doors and into the open air. They climbed a wide stairway.
We just finished the roof deck, he said. I think you'll like it.
When they reached the top of the stairs, the view was spectacular. The roof overlooked most of the campus, the surrounding city of San Vincenzo, and the bay beyond. May and Dan took it all in, and then he turned to her.
May, now that you're aboard, I wanted to get across some of the core beliefs here at the company, and chief among them is that just as important as the work we do here, and that work is very important, we want to make sure that you can be a human being here, too.
We want this to be a workplace, sure, but it should also be a human place. And that means the fostering of community. In fact, it must be a community.
That's one of our slogans, as you probably know. Community first. And you've seen the signs that say humans work here.
I insist on those. That's my pet issue. We're not automatons. This isn't a sweatshop. We're a group of the best minds of our generation. Generations. And making sure this is a place where our humanity is respected, where our opinions are dignified, where our voices are heard, this is as important as any revenue, any stock price, any endeavor undertaken here. Does that sound corny?
No, no, May rushed to say.
Definitely not. That's why I'm here. I love the community first idea. Annie's been telling me about it since she started. At my last job, no one really communicated very well. It was basically the opposite of here in every way.
Dan turned to look into the hills to the east, covered in mohair and patches of green.
I hate hearing that kind of thing. With the technology available, communication should never be in doubt. Understanding should never be out of reach or anything but clear. It's what we do here. You might say it's the mission of the company. It's an obsession of mine, anyway. Communication, understanding, clarity.
Dan nodded emphatically, as if his mouth had just uttered independently something that his ears found quite profound.
In the Renaissance, as you know, we're in charge of the customer experience, CE, and some people might think that's the least sexy part of this whole enterprise, but as I see it, and the wise men see it, it's the foundation of everything that happens here. If we don't give the customers a satisfying, human, and humane experience, then we have no customers. It's pretty elemental. We're the proof that this company is human.
May didn't know what to say. She agreed completely. Her last boss, Kevin, couldn't talk like this. Kevin had no philosophy. Kevin had no ideas. Kevin had only his odors and his mustache. May was grinning like an idiot.
I know you'll be great here, he said, and his arm extended toward her as if he wanted to put his palm on her shoulder, but thought against it. His hand fell to his side. Let's go downstairs and you can get started.
They left the roof deck and descended the wide stairs. They returned to her desk, where they saw a fuzzy-haired man.
There he is, Dan said. Early as always. Hi, Jared.
Jared's face was serene, unlined, his hands resting patiently and unmoving in his ample lap. He was wearing khaki pants and a button-down shirt a size too small.
Jared will be doing your training, and he'll be your main contact here at CE. I oversee the team, and Jared oversees the unit, so we're the two main names you'll need to know. Jared, you ready to get May started?
I am, he said. Hi, May.
He stood, extended his hand, and May shook it. It was rounded and soft, like a cherub's. Dan said goodbye to both of them and left. Jared grinned and ran a hand through his fuzzy hair.
So, training time. You feel ready?
Absolutely.
You need coffee or tea or anything?
May shook her head. I'm all set.
Good. Let's sit down.
May sat down, and Jared pulled his chair next to hers.
Okay. As you know, for now, you're just doing straight-up customer maintenance for the smaller advertisers. They send a message to customer experience, and it gets routed to one of us. Random at first, but once you start working with a customer, that customer will continue to be routed to you for the sake of continuity. When you get the query, you figure out the answer, you write them back. That's the core of it. Simple enough, in theory. So far, so good?
May nodded, and he went through the 20 most common requests and questions and showed her a menu of boilerplate responses.
Now, that doesn't mean you just paste the answer in and send it back. You should make each response personal, specific. You're a person and they're a person, so you shouldn't be imitating a robot and you shouldn't treat them like they're robots. Know what I mean? No robots work here. We never want the customer to think they're dealing with a faceless entity, so you should always be sure to inject humanity into the process. That sound good?
May nodded. She liked that. No robots work here. They went through a dozen or so practice scenarios, and May polished her answers a bit more each time. Jared was a patient trainer and walked her through every customer eventuality. In the event that she was stumped, she could bounce the query to his own queue and he'd take it. That's what he did most of the day, Jared said, take and answer the stumpers from the junior customer experience reps.
But those will be pretty rare. You'd be surprised at how many of the questions you'll be able to field right away. Now, let's say you've answered a client's question, and they seem satisfied. That's when you send them the survey, and they fill it out. It's a set of quick questions about your service, their overall experience, and at the end, they're asked to rate it.
They send the questions back, and then you immediately know how you did. The rating pops up here.
He pointed to the corner for a screen, where there was a large number, 99, and below, a grid of other numbers.
The big 99 is the last customer's rating. The customer will rate you on a scale of, guess what, 1 to 100. That most recent rating will pop up here, and then that'll be averaged with the rest of the day's scores in this next box. That way you'll always know how you're doing, recently and generally. Now, I know what you're thinking. Okay, Jared, what kind of average is average? And the answer is, if it dips below 95, then you might step back and see what you can do better. Maybe you bring the average up with the next customer. Maybe you see how you might improve. Now, if it's consistently slumping, then you might have a meetup with Dan or another team leader to go over some best practices. Sound good?
It does, May said.
I really appreciate this, Jared. In my previous job, I was in the dark about where I stood until, like, quarterly evaluations. It was nerve-wracking.
Well, you'll love this, then. If they fill out the survey and do the rating, and pretty much everyone does, then you send them the next message. This one thanks them for filling out the survey, and it encourages them to tell a friend about the experience they just had with you, using the Circle's social media tools. Ideally, they at least zing it or give you a smile or a frown. In a best-case scenario, you might get them to zing about it or write about it on another customer service site. We get people out there zinging about their great customer service experiences with you, then everyone wins. Got it?
Got it.
Okay, let's do a live one. Ready?
May wasn't, but couldn't say that.
Ready.
Jared brought up a customer request, and after reading it, let out a quick snort to indicate its elementary nature. He chose a boilerplate answer, adapted it a bit, told the customer to have a fantastic day. The exchange took about 90 seconds, and 2 minutes later, the screen confirmed the customer had answered the questionnaire, and a score appeared. 99. Jared sat back and turned to May.
Now that's good, right? 99 is good, but I can't help wondering why it wasn't 100.
Let's look. He opened up the customer's survey answers and scanned through.
Well, there's no clear sign that any part of their experience was unsatisfactory. Now, most companies would say, wow, 99 out of 100 points, that's nearly perfect. And I say, exactly, it's nearly perfect, sure. But at the Circle, that missing point nags at us. So let's see if we can get to the bottom of it. Here's a follow-up that we send out.
He showed her another survey, this one shorter, asking the customer what about their interaction could have been improved and how. They sent it to the customer. Seconds later, the response came back. All was good. Sorry, should have given you 100. Thanks.
Jared tapped the screen and gave a thumbs up to May.
Okay, sometimes you might just encounter someone who isn't really sensitive to the metrics, so it's good to ask them to make sure you get that clarity. Now we're back to a perfect score. You ready to do your own?
I am.
They downloaded another customer query, and May scrolled through the boilerplates, found the appropriate answer, personalized it, and sent it back. When the survey came back, her rating was 100. Jared seemed briefly taken aback.
First one you get, 100? Wow, he said. I knew you'd be good.
He had lost his footing, but now regained it.
Okay, I think you're ready to take on some more. Now, a couple more things. Let's turn on your second screen.
He turned on a smaller screen to her right.
This one is for intra-office messaging. All Circlers send messages out through your main feed, but they appear on the second screen. This is to make clear the importance of the messages and to help you delineate which is which. From time to time, you'll see messages from me over here, just checking in or with some adjustment or news, okay?
Got it.
Now, remember to bounce any stumpers to me, and if you need to stop and talk, you can shoot me a message or stop by. I'm just down the hall. I expect you to be in touch pretty frequently for the first few weeks, one way or the other. That's how I know you're learning. So don't hesitate.
I won't.
Great. Now, are you ready to get started?
I am.
Okay, that means I open the chute. And when I release this deluge on you, you'll have your own cue, and you'll be inundated for the next 2 hours till lunch. You ready?
May felt she was.
I am.
Are you sure? Okay, then.
He activated her account, gave her a mock salute, and left. The chute opened, and in the first 12 minutes, she answered 4 requests, her score at 96. She was sweating heavily, but the rush was electric. A message from Jared appeared on her second screen.
great so far. Let's see if we can get that up to 97 soon.
I will,
she wrote. And send follow-ups to the sub-100s.
Okay,
she wrote. She sent out 7 follow-ups, and 3 customers adjusted their scores to 100. She answered another 10 questions by 11:45. Now her aggregate was 98. Another message appeared on her second screen, this one from Dan.
Fantastic work, May. How you feeling?
May was astonished. A team leader who checked in with you? And so kindly on the first day?
Fine, thanks,
she wrote back and brought up the next customer request. Another message from Jared appeared below the first.
Anything I can do? Questions I can answer?
No thanks, she wrote. I'm all set for now. Thanks, Jared.
She returned to the first screen. Another message from Jared popped up on the second.
Remember, I can only help you if you tell me how.
Thanks again, she wrote.
By lunch, she had answered 36 requests, and her score was at 97. A message from Jared came through.
Well done. Let's follow up on any remaining sub-100s.
Will do,
she answered, and sent out the follow-ups to those she hadn't already handled. She brought a few 98s to 100, and then saw a message from Dan.
Great work, May.
Seconds later, a second screen message, this one from Annie, appeared below Dan's.
Dan says you're kicking ass. That's my girl.
And then a message told her she'd been mentioned on Zing. She clicked over to read it. It was written by Annie.
Newbie May is kicking ass.
She'd sent it out to the rest of the Circle campus. 10,041 people. The Zing was forwarded 322 times, and there were 187 follow-up comments. They appeared on her second screen in an ever-lengthening thread. May didn't have time to read them all, but she scrolled quickly through, and the validation felt good. At the end of the day, May's score was 98. Congratulatory messages arrived from Jared and Dan and Annie. A series of zings followed, announcing and celebrating what Annie called
the highest score of any CE noob ever of all time. Suck it.
By her first Friday, May had served 436 customers and had memorized the boilerplates. Nothing surprised her anymore, though the variation in customers and their businesses was dizzying. The circle was everywhere, and though she'd known this for years intuitively, hearing from these people, the businesses counting on the circle to get the word out about their products, to track their digital impact, to know who was buying their wares and when, it became real on a very different level. May now had customer contacts in Clinton, Louisiana, and Putney, Vermont, and Marmaris, Turkey, and Melbourne, and Glasgow, and Kyoto. Invariably, they were polite in their queries, the legacy of True You, and gracious in their ratings. By mid-morning that Friday, her aggregate for the week was at 97, and the affirmations were coming from everyone in the circle. The work was demanding, and the flow did not stop, but it varied just enough, and the validation was frequent enough, that she settled into a comfortable rhythm. Just as she was about to take another request, a text came through her phone. It was Annie.
Eat with me, fool.
They sat on a low hill, 2 salads between them, the sun making intermittent appearances behind slow-moving clouds. May and Annie watched a trio of young men, pale and dressed like engineers, attempting to throw a football.
So you're already a star.
I feel like a proud mama.
May shook her head.
I'm not at all. I have a lot to learn.
Of course you do. But a 97 so far? That's insane. I didn't get above 95 the first week. You're a natural.
A pair of shadows darkened their lunch.
Can we meet the newbie?
May looked up, shielding her eyes.
Course,
Annie said. The shadows sat down. Annie jabbed her fork at them.
This is Sabine and Joseph.
May shook their hands. Sabine was blonde, sturdy, squinting. Joseph was thin, pale, with comically bad teeth.
Already she's looking at my teeth,
he wailed, pointing to May.
You Americans are obsessed. I feel like a horse at an auction.
But your teeth are bad,
Annie said.
And we have such a good dental plan here.
Joseph unwrapped a burrito.
I think my teeth provide a necessary respite from the eerie perfection of everyone else's.
Annie tilted her head, studying him.
I'm sure you should fix them, if not for you, for the sake of company morale. You give people nightmares.
Joseph pouted theatrically, his mouth full of carne asada. Annie patted his arm. Sabine turned to May.
So you're in customer experience?
Now May noticed the tattoo on Sabine's arm, the symbol for infinity.
I am, first week. I saw you're doing pretty well so far. I started there too, just about everyone did.
And Sabine's a biochemist,
Annie added. May was surprised. You're a biochemist?
I am.
May hadn't heard about biochemists working at the Circle.
Can I ask what you're working on?
Can you ask? Sabine smiled.
Of course you can ask, but I don't have to tell you anything.
Everyone sighed for a moment, but then Sabine stopped.
Seriously, though, I can't tell you. Not right now, anyway. Generally, I work on stuff for the biometric side of things. You know, iris scanning and facial recognition. But right now, I'm on something new. Even though I'd like to...
Annie gave Sabine an imploring, quieting look. Sabine filled her mouth with lettuce.
Anyway,
Annie said,
Joseph here is in educational access. He's trying to get tablets into schools that right now can't afford them. He's a do-gooder. He's also friends with your new friend, Garbanzo.
Garaventa, May corrected.
Ah, you do remember. Have you seen him again?
Not this week. It's been too busy.
Now Joseph's mouth was open. Something had just dawned on him.
Are you May?
Annie winced.
We already said that. Of course this is May. Sorry, I didn't hear it right. Now I know who you are.
Annie snorted.
What, did you two little girls tell each other all about Francis's big night? He's been writing May's name in his notebook, surrounded by hearts?
Joseph inhaled indulgently.
No, he just said he'd met someone very nice, and her name was May.
That's so sweet, Sabine said.
He told her he was in security,
Annie said.
Why would he do that, Joseph?
That's not what he said,
May insisted.
I told you that.
Annie didn't seem to care.
Well, I guess you could call it security. He's in child safety. He's basically the core of this whole program to prevent abductions. He actually could do it.
Sabine, her mouth full again, was nodding vigorously.
Of course he will,
she said, spraying fragments of salad and vinaigrette.
It's a done deal.
What is? May asked. He's going to prevent all abductions?
He could, Joseph said. He's motivated.
Annie's eyes went wide. Did he tell you about his sisters? May shook her head.
No, he didn't say he had siblings. What about his sisters?
All three circlers looked at each other, as if to gauge if the story had to be told there and then.
It's the worst story,
Annie said.
His parents were such fuck-ups. I think there were like four or five kids in the family, and Francis was youngest or second youngest, and anyway the dad was in jail and the mom was on drugs, so the kids were sent all over the place. I think one went to his aunt and uncle, and his two sisters were sent to some foster home, and then they were abducted from there. I guess there was some doubt if they were, you know, given or sold to the murderers.
The what?
May had gone limp.
Oh, God, they were raped and kept in closets and their bodies were dropped down some kind of abandoned missile silo. I mean, it was the worst story ever. He told a bunch of us about it when he was pitching this child safety program.
Shit, look at your face. I shouldn't have said all this.
May couldn't speak.
It's important that you know, Joseph said. This is why he's so passionate. I mean, his plan would pretty much eliminate the possibility of anything like this ever happening again. Wait. What time is it?
Annie checked her phone. You're right. We gotta scoot. Bailey's doing an unveiling. We should be in the Great Hall. The Great Hall was in the Enlightenment, and when they entered the venue, a 3,500-seat cavern appointed in warm woods and brushed steel, it was loud with anticipation. May and Annie found one of the last pairs of seats in the second balcony and sat down.
"Just finished this a few months ago," Annie said.
$45 million.
Bailey modeled the stripes off the Duomo in Siena. Nice, right?
May's attention was pulled to the stage, where a man was walking to a Lucite podium amid a roar of applause. He was a tall man of about 45, round in the gut, but not unhealthy, wearing jeans and blue V-neck sweater. There was no discernible microphone, but when he began speaking, his voice was amplified and clear.
"Hello, everyone. My name is Eamon Bailey," he said, to another round of applause that he quickly discouraged. "Thank you. I'm so glad to see you all here. A bunch of you are new to the company since I last spoke one whole month ago. Can the newbies stand up?"
Annie nudged May. May stood and looked around the auditorium to see about 60 other people standing, most of them her age, all of them seeming shy, all of them quietly stylish, together representing every race and ethnicity and, thanks to the circle's efforts to ease permits for international staffers, a dizzying range of national origins. The clapping from the rest of the circlers was loud, a sprinkling of whoops mixed in. She sat down.
"You're so cute when you blush," Annie said.
May sunk into her seat.
"Newbies," Bailey said, "you're in for something special. This is called Dream Friday, when we present something we're working on. Often it's one of our engineers or designers or visionaries, and sometimes it's just me. And today, for better or for worse, it's just me. For that, I apologize in advance."
"We love you, Eamon,"
came a voice from the audience. Laughter followed.
"Well, thank you," he said. "I love you back. I love you as the grass loves the dew, as the birds love a bough."
He paused briefly, allowing May to catch her breath. She'd seen these talks online, but being here, in person, seeing Bailey's mind at work, hearing his off-the-cuff eloquence, it was better than she thought possible. What would it be like, she thought, to be someone like that, eloquent and inspirational, so at ease in front of thousands?
"Yes," he continued. "It's been a whole month since I've gotten up on this stage, and I know my replacements have been unsatisfying. I am sorry to deprive you of myself. I realize there is no substitute."
The joke brought laughter throughout the hall.
"And I know a lot of you have been wondering just where the heck I've been."
A voice from the front of the room yelled,
"Surfing?"
And the room laughed.
"Well, that's right. I have been doing some surfing, and that's part of what I'm here to talk about. I love to surf, and when I want to surf, I need to know how the waves are. Now, it used to be that you'd wake up and call the local surf shop and ask them about the breaks, and pretty soon they stopped answering their phones."
Knowing laughter came from the older contingent in the room.
"When cell phones proliferated, you could call your buddies who might have gotten out to the beach before you. They, too, stopped answering their phones."
Another big laugh from the audience.
"Seriously, though, it's not practical to make 12 calls every morning, and can you trust someone else's take on the conditions? The surfers don't want any more bodies on the limited breaks we get up here. So then the internet happened, and here and there some geniuses set up cameras on the beaches. We could log on and get some pretty crude images of the waves at Stinson Beach. It was almost worse than calling the surf shop. The technology was pretty primitive. Streaming technology still is. Or was. Until now."
A screen descended behind him.
"Okay, here's how it used to look."
The screen showed a standard browser display, and an unseen hand typed in the URL for a website called SurfSite. A poorly designed site appeared, with a tiny image of a coastline streaming in the middle. It was pixelated and comically slow. The audience tittered.
"Almost useless, right? Now, as we know, streaming video has gotten a lot better in recent years, but it's still slower than real life, and the screen quality is pretty disappointing. So we've solved, I think, the quality issues in the last year. Let's now refresh that page to show the site with our new video delivery."
Now the page was refreshed, and the coastline was full screen, and the resolution was perfect. There were sounds of awe throughout the room.
"Yes, this is live video of Stinson Beach. This is Stinson right at this moment. Looks pretty good, right?" Maybe I should be out there as opposed to standing here with you. Annie leaned into May.
The next part's incredible. Just wait.
Now, many of you still aren't so impressed. As we all know, many machines can deliver high-res streaming video, and many of your tablets and phones can already support them. But there are a couple new aspects to all this. The first part is how we're getting this image. Would it surprise you to know that this isn't coming from a big camera, but actually just one of these?
He was holding a small device in his hand, the shape and size of a lollipop.
This is a video camera, and this is the precise model that's getting this incredible image quality. Image quality that holds up to this kind of magnification. So that's the first great thing. We can now get high-def quality resolution in a camera the size of a thumb. Well, a very big thumb. The second great thing is that, as you can see, this camera needs no wires. It's transmitting this image via satellite.
A round of applause shook the room.
Wait. Did I say it runs on a lithium battery that lasts 2 years? No? Well, it does. And we're a year away from an entirely solar-powered model, too. And it's waterproof, sandproof, windproof, animal-proof, insect-proof, everything-proof.
More applause overtook the room.
Okay, so I set up that camera this morning. I taped it to a stake, stuck that stake in the sand, in the dunes, with no permit, nothing. In fact, no one knows it's there. So this morning I turned it on, then I drove back to the office, accessed camera one, Stinson Beach, and I got this image. Not bad. But that's not the half of it. Actually, I was pretty busy this morning. I drove around and set up one at Rodeo Beach, too.
And now the original image of Stinson Beach shrunk and moved to a corner of the screen. Another box emerged, showing the waves at Rodeo Beach a few miles down the Pacific coast.
And now Montara and Ocean Beach, Fort Point.
With each beach Bailey mentioned, another live image appeared. There were now 6 beaches in a grid, each of them live, visible with perfect clarity and brilliant color.
Now remember, no one sees these cameras. I've hidden them pretty well. To the average person, they look like weeds or some kind of stick. Anything. They're unnoticed, so in a few hours this morning, I set up perfectly clear video access to 6 locations that helped me know how to plan my day. And everything we do here is about knowing the previously unknown, right?
Heads nodded, a smattering of applause.
Okay, so many of you are thinking, well, this is just like closed-circuit TV crossed with streaming technology, satellites, all that. Fine. But as you know, to do this with extant technology would have been prohibitively expensive for the average person. But what if all this was accessible and affordable to anyone? My friends, we're looking at retailing these in just a few months, mind you, at $59 each.
Bailey held the lollipop camera out and threw it to someone in the front row. The woman who caught it held it aloft, turning to the audience and smiling gleefully.
You can buy 10 of them for Christmas, and suddenly you have constant access to everywhere you want to be. Home, work, traffic conditions, and anyone can install them. It takes 5 minutes tops. Think of the implications.
The screen behind him cleared, the beaches disappearing, and a new grid appeared.
Here's the view from my backyard, he said, revealing a live feed of a tidy and modest backyard. Here's my front yard, my garage. Here's one on a hill overlooking Highway 101 where it gets bad during rush hour. Here's one near my parking space to make sure no one parks there.
And soon, the screen had 16 discrete images on it, all of them transmitting live feed.
Now, these are just my cameras. I access them all by simply typing in camera 1, 2, 3, 12, whatever. Easy. But what about sharing? That is, what if my buddy has some cameras posted and wants to give me access?
And now the screen's grid multiplied from 16 boxes to 32.
Here's Lionel Fitzpatrick's screens. He's into skiing, so he's got cameras positioned so he can tell the conditions at 12 locations all over Tahoe.
Now there were 12 live images of white-topped mountains, ice-blue valleys, ridges topped with deep green conifers.
Lionel can give me access to any of the cameras he wants. It's just like friending someone. But now with access to all their live feeds, forget cable, forget 500 channels, if you have 1,000 friends and they have 10 cameras each, you now have 10,000 options for live footage. If you have 5,000 friends, you have 50,000 options. And soon, you'll be able to connect to millions of cameras around the world. Again, imagine the implications.
The screen atomized into 1,000 mini-screens. Beaches, mountains, lakes, cities, offices, living rooms. The crowd applauded wildly. Then the screen went blank, and from the black emerged a peace sign, in white.
Now imagine the human rights implications. Protesters on the streets of Egypt no longer have to hold up a camera, hoping to catch a human rights violation or a murder, and then somehow get the footage out of the streets and online. Now it's as easy as gluing a camera to a wall. Actually, we've done just that.
A stunned hush came over the audience.
Let's have camera 8 in Cairo.
A live shot of a street scene appeared. There were banners lying on the street, a pair of police in riot gear standing in the distance.
They don't know we see them, but we do.
The world is watching and listening.
Turn up the audio.
Suddenly, they could hear a clear conversation in Arabic between pedestrians passing near the camera, unawares.
And of course, most of the cameras can be manipulated manually or with voice recognition. Watch this. Camera 8, turn left.
On screen, the camera's view of the Cairo street panned left.
Now right.
It panned right. He demonstrated it moving up, down, diagonally, all with remarkable fluidity. The audience applauded again.
Now remember that these cameras are cheap and easy to hide, and they need no wires. So it hasn't been that hard for us to place them all over. Let's show Tahrir.
Gasps from the audience. On screen, there was now a live shot of Tahrir Square, the cradle of the Egyptian Revolution.
We've had our people in Cairo attaching cameras for the last week. They're so small the army can't find them. They don't even know where to look. Let's show the rest of the views. Camera 2, camera 3, 4, 5, 6.
There were 6 shots of the square, each so clear that sweat on any face could be seen. The name tags of every soldier easily read.
Now 7 through 50.
Now there was a grid of 50 images, seeming to cover the entire public space. The audience roared again. Bailey raised his hands as if to say, "Not yet. There's plenty more."
The square is quiet now, but can you imagine if something happened? There would be instant accountability. Any soldier committing an act of violence would instantly be recorded for posterity. He could be tried for war crimes, you name it. And even if they clear the square of journalists, the cameras are still there. And no matter how many times they try to eliminate the cameras, because they're so small, they'll never know for sure where they are, who's placed them where and when. And the not knowing will prevent abuses of power. You take the average soldier who's now worried that a dozen cameras will catch him, for all eternity, dragging some woman down the street? Well, he should worry. He should worry about these cameras. He should worry about sea change. That's what we're calling them.
There was a quick burst of applause, which grew as the audience came to understand the double meaning at play.
Like it? Bailey said. Okay, now, this doesn't just apply to areas of upheaval. Imagine any city with this kind of coverage. Who would commit a crime knowing they might be watched anytime, anywhere? My friends in the FBI feel this would cut crime rates down by 70-80% in any city where we have real and meaningful saturation.
The applause grew.
But for now, let's go back to the places in the world where we most need transparency and so rarely have it. Here's a medley of locations around the world where we've placed cameras. Now imagine the impact these cameras would have had in the past and will have in the future if similar events transpire. Here's 50 cameras in Tiananmen Square.
Live shots from all over the square filled the screen, and the crowd erupted again. Bailey went on, revealing their coverage of a dozen authoritarian regimes, from Khartoum to Pyongyang, where the authorities had no idea they were being watched by 3,000 circlers in California.
had no notion that they could be watched, that this technology was or would ever be possible. Now Bailey cleared the screen again and stepped toward the audience.
You know what I say, right? In situations like this, I agree with The Hague, with human rights activists the world over. There needs to be accountability. Tyrants can no longer hide. There needs to be, and will be, documentation and accountability, and we need to bear witness. And to this end, I insist that all that happens should be known.
The words dropped onto the screen. All that happens must be known.
Folks, we're at the dawn of the Second Enlightenment, and I'm not talking about a new building on campus. I'm talking about an era where we don't allow the majority of human thought and action and achievement and learning to escape as if from a leaky bucket. We did that once before. It was called the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages. If not for the monks, everything the world had ever learned would have been lost. Well, we live in a similar time, when we're losing the vast majority of what we do and see and learn. But it doesn't have to be that way. Not with these cameras, and not with the mission of the Circle.
He turned again toward the screen and read it, inviting the audience to commit it to memory. All that happens must be known. He turned back to the audience and smiled.
Okay, now I want to bring it back home. My mother's 81. She doesn't get around as easily as she once did. A year ago, she fell and broke her hip, and since then I've been concerned about her. I asked her to have some security cameras installed so I could access them on a closed circuit, but she refused. But now I have peace of mind. Last weekend, while she was napping,
a wave of laughter rippled through the audience.
Forgive me, he said. I had no choice. She wouldn't let me do it otherwise. So I snuck in and I installed cameras in every room. They're so small she'll never notice. I'll show you really quick. Can we show cameras 1 to 5 in my mom's house?
A grid of images popped up, including his mom patting down a bright hallway in a towel. A roar of laughter erupted.
Oops, let's drop that one.
The image disappeared.
Anyway, the point is that I know she's safe, and that gives me a sense of peace. As we all know here at the Circle, transparency leads to peace of mind. No longer do I have to wonder, how's Mom? No longer do I have to wonder, what's happening in Myanmar?
Now, we're making a million of this model, and my prediction is that within a year, we'll have 1 million accessible live streams. Within 5 years, 50 million. Within 10 years, 2 billion cameras. There will be very few populated areas that we won't be able to access from the screens in our hands. The audience roared again. Someone yelled out,
"We want it now!"
Bailey continued.
Instead of searching the web only to find some edited video with terrible quality, now you go to See Change, you type in Myanmar, or you type in your high school boyfriend's name, chances are there's someone who's set up a camera nearby, right? Why shouldn't your curiosity about the world be rewarded? You want to see Fiji but can't get there? See Change. You want to check on your kid at school? See Change. This is ultimate transparency. No filter. See everything. Always.
May leaned toward Annie. This is incredible.
I know, right?
Annie said.
Now, do these cameras have to be stationary?
Bailey said, raising a scolding finger.
Of course not. I happen to have 12 helpers all over the world right now, wearing the cameras around their necks. Let's visit them, shall we?
Can I get Danny's camera up?
An image of Machu Picchu appeared on screen. It looked like a postcard, a view perched high above the ancient ruins, and then it started moving down toward the site. The crowd gasped, then cheered.
That's a live image. Well, I guess that's obvious. Hi, Danny. Now let's get Sarah on Mount Kenya.
Another image appeared on the great screen, this one of the shale fields high on the mountain.
Can you point us toward the peak, Sarah?
The camera panned up, revealing the peak of the mountain enshrouded in fog.
See, this opens up the possibility of visual surrogates. Imagine I'm bedridden or too frail to explore the mountain myself. I send someone up with a camera around her neck, and I can experience it all in real time. Let's do that in a few more places.
He presented live images of Paris, Kuala Lumpur, a London pub.
Now let's experiment a bit. Using all of this together, I'm sitting at home, I log on, and want to get a sense of the world. Show me traffic on 101, streets of Jakarta, surfing at Bolinas, my mom's house. Show me the webcams of everyone I went to high school with.
At every command, new images appeared, until there were at least 100 live streaming images on the screen at once.
We will become all-seeing, all-knowing.
The audience was standing now. The applause thundered through the room. May rested her head on Annie's shoulder.
All that happens will be known, Annie whispered.
You have a glow.
You do. I do not have a glow.
Like you're with child.
I know what you meant. Stop.
May's father reached across the table and took her hand. It was Saturday, and her parents were treating her to a celebratory dinner commemorating her first week at the Circle. This was the kind of sentimental slop they were always doing, at least recently. When she was younger, the only child of a couple who long considered the possibility of having none at all, their home was more complicated. During the week, her father had been scarce. He'd been the building manager at a Fresno office park, working 14-hour days and leaving everything at home to her mother, who worked three shifts a week at a hotel restaurant and who responded to the pressure of it all with a hair-trigger temper, primarily directed at May. But when May was 10, her parents announced they'd bought a parking lot, two stories, near downtown Fresno, and for a few years they took turns manning it. It was humiliating to May to have her friend's parents say, "Hey, saw your mom at the lot," or "Tell your dad thanks again for comping me the other day." But soon their finances stabilized, and they could hire a couple guys to trade shifts. And when her parents could take a day off and could plan more than a few months ahead, they mellowed, becoming a very calm, exasperatingly sweet older couple. It was as if they went, in the course of a year, from being young parents in over their heads to grandparents, slow-moving and warm and clueless about what exactly their daughter wanted. When she graduated from middle school, they'd driven her to Disneyland, not quite understanding that she was too old and that her going there alone, with two adults, which was effectively alone, was at cross-purposes with any notion of fun. But they were so well-meaning that she couldn't refuse, and in the end they had a mindless kind of fun that she didn't know was possible with one's parents. Any lingering resentment she might direct at them for the emotional uncertainties of her early life was doused by the constant cool water of their late middle age. And now they'd driven to the bay to spend the weekend at the cheapest bed and breakfast they could find, which was 15 miles from the Circle, and looked haunted. Now they were out at some fake fancy restaurant the two of them had heard about, and if anyone was aglow, it was them. They were beaming.
So? It's been great? Her mother asked. It has.
I knew it.
Her mother sat back, crossing her arms.
I don't ever want to work anywhere else, May said.
What a relief, her father said.
We don't want you working anywhere else either.
Her mother lunged forward and took May's arm.
I told Carolina's mom, you know her.
She scrunched her nose, the closest she could come to an insult.
She looked like someone had stuck a sharp stick up her behind, boiling with envy.
Mom.
I let your salary slip.
Mom?
I just said I hope she can get by with a salary of $60,000.
I can't believe you told her that.
It's true, isn't it?
It's actually 62.
Oh, geez, now I have to call her up.
No, you won't.
Okay, I won't. But it's been very fun, she said. I just casually slip it into conversation. My daughter's at the hottest company on the planet and has full dental.
Please don't. I just got lucky, and Annie...
Her father leaned forward.
How is Annie?
Good.
Tell Annie we love her.
I will.
She couldn't come tonight?
No, she's busy.
But you asked her.
I did. She says hi, but she works a lot.
What does she do exactly?
Her mother asked.
Everything, really, May said. She's in the Gang of 40. She's part of all the big decisions. I think she specializes in dealing with regulatory issues in other countries.
I'm sure she's got a lot of responsibility.
And stock options,
her father said.
I can't imagine what she's worth.
Dad, don't imagine that.
Why is she working with all those stock options? I'd be on a beach. I'd have a harem.
May's mother put her hand on his. Vinny, stop. Then to May, she said, I hope she has time to enjoy it all.
She does, May said. She's probably at a campus party as we speak.
Her father smiled.
I love that you call it a campus. That's very cool. We used to call those places offices.
May's mother seemed troubled.
A party, May? You didn't want to go? I did, but I wanted to see you guys, and there are plenty of those parties.
But in your first week?
Her mother looked pained.
Maybe you should have gone. Now I feel bad. We took you away from it.
Trust me, they have them every other day. They're very social over there. I'll be fine.
You're not taking lunch yet, are you?
Her mother asked. She made the same point when May had started at the utility. Don't take lunch your first week. Sends the wrong message.
Don't worry, May said. I haven't even used the bathroom.
Her mother rolled her eyes.
Anyway, let me just say how proud we are. We love you.
And Annie,
her father said.
Right, we love you and Annie.
They ate quickly, knowing that May's father would soon tire. He'd insisted on going out to dinner, though back at home he rarely did anymore. His fatigue was constant and could come on suddenly and strong, sending him to near collapse. It was important, when out like this, to be ready to make a quick exit, and before dessert, they did so. May followed them back to their room, and there, amid the B&B owner's dozens of dolls spread about the room and watching, May and her parents were able to relax, unafraid of eventualities. May hadn't gotten used to her father having multiple sclerosis. The diagnosis had come down only 2 years earlier, though the symptoms had been visible years before that. He'd been slurring his words, had been overshooting when reaching for things, and finally had fallen twice, each time in the foyer of their house, reaching for the front door. So they'd sold the parking lot, made a decent profit, and now spent their time managing his care, which meant at least a few hours a day poring over medical bills and battling with the insurance company.
Oh, we saw Mercer the other day,
her mother said, and her father smiled. Mercer had been a boyfriend of May's, one of the four serious ones she'd had in high school and college, but as far as her parents were concerned, he was the only one who mattered, or the only one they acknowledged or remembered. It helped that he still lived in town.
That's good, May said, wanting to end the topic. He still makes chandeliers out of antlers?
Easy there, her father said, hearing her barbed tone. He's got his own business, and not that he'd brag, but it's apparently thriving.
May needed to change the subject.
I've averaged 97 so far, she said. They say that's a record for a newbie.
The look on her parents' faces was bewilderment. Her father blinked slowly. They had no idea what she was talking about.
What's that, hon?
Her father said. May let it go. When she'd heard the words leave her mouth, she knew the sentence would take too long to explain.
How are things with the insurance? She asked, and instantly regretted it.
Why did she ask questions like this? The answer would swallow the night.
Not good, her mother said. I don't know. We have the wrong plan. I mean, they don't want to insure your dad, plain and simple. And they seem to be doing everything they can to get us to leave. But how can we leave? We'd have nowhere to go.
Her father sat up.
Tell her about the prescription.
Oh, right. Your dad's been on Copaxone for 2 years. For the pain, he needs it. Without it,
the pain gets ornery, he said.
Now the insurance says he doesn't need it. It's not on their list of pre-approved medications, even though he's been using it 2 years.
It seems unnecessarily cruel, May's father said.
They've offered no alternative, nothing for the pain.
May didn't know what to say. I'm sorry. Can I look up some alternatives online? I mean, have you seen if the doctors could find another drug that the insurance will pay for? Maybe a generic? This went on for an hour, and by the end, May was wrecked. The MS, her helplessness to slow it, her inability to bring back the life her father had known, it tortured her.
But the insurance situation was something else, was an unnecessary crime, a piling on. Didn't the insurance companies realize that the cost of their obfuscation, denial, all the frustration they caused, only made her father's health worse and threatened that of her mother? If nothing else, it was inefficient. The time spent denying coverage, arguing, dismissing, thwarting, surely it was more trouble than simply granting her parents access to the right care.
"Enough of this," her mother said. "We brought you a surprise."
"Where is it? You have it, Vinny?" They gathered on the high bed, covered with a threadbare patchwork quilt, and her father presented May with a small, wrapped gift. The size and shape of the box suggested a necklace, but May knew it couldn't be that. When she got the wrapping off, she opened the velvet box and laughed. It was a pen, one of the rarefied kind that's silver and strangely heavy, requiring care and filling and mostly for show.
"Don't worry, we didn't buy it," May's father said.
"Vinny!"
her mother wailed.
"Seriously," he said. "We didn't. A friend of mine gave it to me last year. He felt bad I couldn't work. I don't know what kind of use he thought I'd have for a pen when I can barely type, but this guy was never so bright."
"We thought it would look good on your desk,"
her mother added.
"Are we the best or what?"
her father said. May's mother laughed, and most crucially, May's father laughed. He laughed a big belly laugh. In the second, calmer phase of their lives as parents, he'd become a laugher, a constant laugher, a man who laughed at everything. It was the primary sound of May's teenage years. He laughed at things that were clearly funny and at things that would provoke just a smile in most, and he laughed when he should have been upset. When May misbehaved, he thought it was hilarious. He'd caught her sneaking out of her bedroom window one night to see Mercer, and he'd practically keeled over. Everything was comical. Everything about her adolescence cracked him up.
"You should have seen your face when you saw me. Priceless."
But then the MS diagnosis arrived, and most of that was gone. The pain was constant. The spells where he couldn't get up, didn't trust his legs to carry him, were too frequent, too dangerous. He was in the emergency room weekly. And finally, with some heroic efforts from May's mom, he saw a few doctors who cared, and he was put on the right drugs and stabilized, at least for a while. And then the insurance debacles, the descent into this healthcare purgatory. This night, though, he was buoyant, and her mother was feeling good, having found some sherry in the B&B's tiny kitchen, which she shared with May. Her father was soon enough asleep in his clothes, over the covers, with all the lights on, with May and her mother still talking at full volume. When they noticed he was out cold, May arranged a bed for herself at the foot of theirs. In the morning, they slept late and drove to a diner for lunch. Her father ate well, and May watched her mother feign nonchalance, the two of them talking about a wayward uncle's latest bizarre business venture, something about raising lobsters in rice paddies. May knew her mother was nervous every moment about her father having him out for two meals in a row, and watched him closely. He looked cheerful, but his strength faded quickly.
"You guys settle up," he said. "I'm going to the car to recline for a moment."
"We can help," May said, but her mother hushed her. Her father was already up and headed for the door.
"He gets tired. It's fine," her mother said. "It's just a different routine now. He rests. He does things. He walks and eats and is